Are you an ambitious business professional ready to take the next step toward advancing your career? It takes just 14 weeks to unlock your true potential with the SEM Leadership Academy from the University of Tennessee Knoxville's Global Supply Chain Institute. Get immediate access to cutting-edge resources and invaluable industry connections with our convenient online format. Secure your spot for our upcoming session starting on January 31st by following the link in the show notes or visiting supplychainmanagement.utk.edu. Accelerate your journey to success with the SEM Leadership Academy.
Welcome to the Tennessee on Supply Chain Management podcast. Listen in as co-hosts Ted Stank and Tom Goldsby set sail into the world of end-to-end supply chain management, diving deep into today's most relevant business topics. They'll share insights and pressing industry issues and tackle the challenges keeping supply chain professionals up at night. If you're enjoying the ride, download and subscribe to Tennessee on Supply Chain Management on your favorite podcast platform now.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Tennessee on Supply Chain Management. It's great to be with you. Coming to you live from the Supply Chain Forum at Rocky Top, University of Tennessee, downtown Knoxville, Tennessee. Tom Goldsby here, your co-host, joined by my good friend and co-host, Dr. Ted Stank. Hey, Ted, how you doing?
Doing great, Tom. Thanks. Hi, everybody. How y'all doing?
Yeah, just point out we do have a live in-studio audience for this, so a special edition of the podcast. And also a very good friend on hand in Mr. Jim Newsom that we're going to get to in short order. But let's go ahead and kind of do a little bit of recap here just to get things started. Certainly a lot going on in the world, in the business world, in the supply chain realm. Where do you think we ought to get started? Do you want to take on geopolitics or where do you want to go?
Let's start a little bit. We'll start closer to home. We'll start with like U.S. gross domestic product growth, some things going on in our economy right now. I think one of the more interesting articles I read was an Economist article Tom sent me a week or so ago that says economists can't figure out what's going on and they don't know why they've been wrong so much about predicting what's happening with inflation, when we're going to come out of a growth period and go into recession. They keep getting surprised. One of the latest surprises was last quarter's U.S. gross domestic product was almost 5%, 4.9%.
Yeah, big.
I mean, who saw that coming, right? Manufacturing starts last month up about 2%. Even in, Jim, this will get into your territory, but I just saw that October container imports was up a couple of percent. So, you know, a lot of good signs despite, you know, inflation. Jobs report in September defied everyone's expectations. Not so high in October, but still pretty healthy growth. Doesn't seem to indicate recession. And yet we all feel those clouds on the horizon.
You all do.
I'll tell you what, go back into
the archives. I've been saying, for one thing, I know that the economists are stumped. I'm an economist in training. I know we're trained to look at these typical barometer readings, but I've said it's kind of bunk to some extent, right? You got some that are pointing up, some that are pointing down. I continue to focus on it, raw emotion and the consumer. And the consumer continues to spend. And that's going to drive the economy.
Yeah, If you check, we've been doing this podcast for over 2 years now, and Tom has consistently said, "No, we're good. No, we're good." And I have just attributed it to him just being an optimistic kind of guy.
I am an optimist, but
whereas I'm the pessimist. I guess we're really good teammates.
Yeah, no,
too.
I guess
something
I guess
like
so.
The world's going to end. We're all going to die.
No, I guess maybe I've been reading into the positives, you know. And as you pointed out, you know, jobs report. So okay, so unemployment ticked up to 3.9%, which, you know, generally speaking, economists feeling pretty good when it's 4% or
right?
south
That's
of that, right? So we're still good. Seems like things are stabilizing. Yeah, I do see business spending slowing down. But, you know, in gross, that's 30% of the economy. Consumer spending, 70%. And I'm seeing indications it's going to be a big holiday, I think. I just think that, again, when all that money got in the hands of the consumer in pandemic, what do you know? They spent it. And they liked spending money. And
you know,
I think they're going to keep
Amazon
doing it.
Amazon Prime Days is always a bellwether for holiday season.
And that
Amazon
was up.
Prime Days was way up. So we'll see. You know, you look at inventory levels, which is another traditional kind of leading indicator of what's happening with the economy. And we've seen high inventory levels. And they have kind of balanced to a more stable, traditional level of inventory, mm-hmm. particularly heading into the holidays. So, I mean, that's an indicator that maybe we will have a decent holiday.
Yeah. I know our friends in transportation, particularly domestic transportation, yeah. trucking, rail, and so forth, have pointed out to this notion of bumping, you know, hitting bottom, things kind of leveling off, and waiting for things to tick upward. But, you know, again, we understood it was going to take some time for that inventory to burn off. I mean, you and I had that Wall Street Journal piece. We predicted in spring of 21, we're going to have this bullwhip effect.
Right.
And, you know, okay, so maybe now, you know, 22, we experienced it, and the economy's starting to feel a little bit more like normal.
I mean, I tend to think about what happened. It's a giant system, right? And there's so many interrelated, complicated parts. And COVID just completely disrupted so many different parts of it. So if you think of any system that once it gets turned off and then you turn it back on, it oscillates for a while with some highs and lows until it finds a steady state. And I think we're still kind of trying to find that steady state.
Maybe we got through that sputter.
After that shock, yeah.
But we're getting there. And so, you know, I continue to be pretty optimistic about things. And I throw away a lot of my economics training, frankly, to focus on the raw emotions of people. And we have recognized, again, consumers spend in a lot of different ways. But, again, you got to tuck in those elbows if you've been on a plane lately. I mean, people are traveling, getting out and about. So that's good.
You want to talk a little bit about the UAW deal and maybe that has on broader labor?
Absolutely. So since we last spoke, I mean, that was red hot. Seemingly they were nowhere close to a deal. And suddenly, you know, I tell you what, this UAW strategy of selectively shutting down operations, particularly things like the Ford plant in Louisville, select truck plants in particular that are very profitable operations. That seemed,
plant in Tennessee.
That's it. It seemed to bring the OEMs to the table.
Well, the whole strategy of striking all three of the major U.S. automakers at one time was innovative as well. I think, though, talking about bellwethers, I think that the UPS contract, the West Coast ports contract, Jim will touch on Gulf and East Coast ports coming up, and the UAW contracts have all been relative wins in the UAW case, major wins for labor. And I think that that is a bellwether of labor management relations in the foreseeable future. A number of unions are talking about taking a tougher stance next time their contracts come up, because I think they're recognizing that there's this imbalance in terms of the number of jobs versus the number of people available for those jobs. And they're seeing that as an opportunity for labor to maybe regain some strength in their negotiating positions with management that, frankly, they've lost over the last few decades.
I think that's true. However, we're also at that inflection point with electric vehicles, right? And EVs, you know, putting together an electric vehicle is a little bit more like playing with Legos. You don't need as many people to turn a wrench on an EV. Something like a Tesla engine has like 20 parts compared to more than 300 parts that go into a conventional engine.
Shaking my head.
Yeah.
I ain't buying EVs, man.
Bring it.
I'm not buying that they are the be-all, end-all, and by 2030 we're all going to be driving.
No, I don't think by 2030, but they're coming.
The U.S. electrical grid can't support it. The infrastructure's not out there for it. And, you know, a couple of the big auto manufacturers bet heavily on EVs. And guess what they have on their lots? EVs, and nobody can get gas or hybrid cars. I've been looking for a good hybrid of the brand that I like to drive, and they don't have them. They don't sell them here. So I don't know.
I'm not completely sold
on EVs. The supply chain for EVs is undeveloped and scary, frankly, in terms of where we're going to get those minerals from. So I'm just not a totally sold.
Well, I mean, this is where a multi-billion dollar, kajillion dollar sort of industry is redefining itself. And they darn well better get it right from an end-to-end perspective, to your point, right? I mean, in terms of being able to define, you know, that end-to-end supply chain.
One word for you, young man. Remember this movie, The Graduate, and the plastics, right? Hydrogen.
Hydrogen, yeah.
Hydrogen. The big gas companies, Exxon, Mobil, are investing in hydrogen. They see hydrogen as the real alternative fuel for the future. I don't know enough of the...
I rode in a hydrogen taxi in Germany.
Did you?
A few months ago. It was phenomenal.
Really?
And I heard this sloshing.
Did it fly?
It did not fly, which that was disappointing. I was hoping it would. But I heard this sloshing as I opened and closed the door, and the driver said, well, that's where the water's stored.
Really?
Yeah.
The water, that's the byproduct of that.
That's right. That's feeding it. Yeah.
Interesting.
So pretty cool. So I saw a little bit of a glimpse of the future. So you might be right there.
What else do we have here, Tom?
Well, I'm just talking
a couple
about
other topics I want to hit before we get to Jim. One of them let's save because it's about the Panama Canal. So we'll save that for you, Jim. The last one, I'm going to save this one for you, too, because you told me one time, don't buy into this. I'm talking about Convoy going bankrupt, Flexport struggling, and all these kind of digital brokerage companies, and you were not bullish on them when the venture capital industry was. So let's bring Jim.
Let's do it.
Okay, I have to read this. I'm going to pick it up and read this. Jim Newsom is our guest. Jim Newsom is the recently retired president of South Carolina Ports Authority, previous president of Hapag-Lloyd North America, has just done amazing things in his career, but I want to read some of his accolades. South Carolina Public Servant of the Year, Agricultural Transportation Coalition Person of the Year, Rainmaker, International Maritime Hall of Fame inductee, Order of the Palmetto, South Carolina's highest civilian honor. That's a really cool one. And then just as of Friday night, the Haslam College of Business's Distinguished Alumni of the Year, which I had the great honor of awarding to Jim in a wonderful ceremony. So let's get Jim's take on some changes in the global supply chain environment and things happening in international trade. Jim literally has connections all over the world. He has introduced us to people in Europe, Asia, Middle East, South and Central America. I've had dinner with you at a few of those different continents. They've always been good. So, Jim, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom and Ted. Really appreciate it. It's an honor to be here.
Well, let's just go ahead and cut to the chase. Where did we get it right? Where did we get it wrong in those opening 7 minutes?
Well, I think the best story about an economist is the best thing is a one-handed economist because they can't keep saying on the other
on
hand.
On the other hand.
But, no, I think you got it essentially right. I think that if I look at what happened in the shipping and port industry, I was in Asia. I used to go to Asia right after Chinese New Year every year, and it was March of 2020, and we would normally go to China, and COVID, this thing called COVID had started. We didn't know what it was then in China, so I bagged that part of the trip. I was just coming back, and the virus was following me back home. And then we had to make a budget because we are July through June fiscal year. So we had never managed in a pandemic. What did a pandemic mean for container flows, container volumes? And gee, I was really pessimistic. I figured we'd lose 25% of our volume, whatever. That's what I told our board. And, of course, what I didn't realize is that in a couple of months, everybody would be bored. They couldn't go anywhere. They were doing 10 hours worth of Zoom calls a day. They look at their couch and say, this is the ugliest couch I've ever seen. I need a new one. So furniture was the number one commodity. And we had 20 months of, and we measure volumes in our shipping industry by imports, about 20 months of 2.5 million TEUs when the port industry had about 2 million. U.S. port industry had about 2 million TEUs. So we stretched every element of the supply chain to its limits, meaning we had days we couldn't unload ships until we took containers out, basically. Shipping lines chartered every ship, even if it wasn't a container ship, they chartered a ship. Truckers were expanding capacity. We had ships waiting 20 days in certain ports, not Charleston, but in other ports. So we went through this boom cycle that really showed how fragile the import global supply chain, the total U.S. global supply chain is. And I think what has happened is we have sort of returned to normal, normal being 2019. Ted mentioned it. We're about 3% up year on year through the totality of the year. I think October was about 11% up, according to Datamine, and that's about 2.3 million TEUs. And I think what happened, the big retailers were facing the same thing. They didn't know what demand would look like, and they were seeing shortages on shelves because the supply chain was getting bogged down. So what was their solution? They just ordered more. You know, order more, deal with it later. And we're still, I think the major thing we're still dealing with today is this inventory overhang in the goods cycle because people switched to going back to Italy, taking trips. And we've still got this big overhang of goods if you look in a lot of the warehouses and stuff. So there's, I think the other point you got right is we're at an inflection point. We really don't know where we're headed. I mean, every indicator says we should have a consumer recession. Mm-hmm. But we don't see that yet. But there are some things in terms of population trends, workforce trends, power trends, EVs that we can talk about a little bit, I think that would be productive.
Yeah, let's do that. couple of things I want to put out there first. What is your take on, you and I talked for a long time over the last, I don't know, almost eight years, right? The new locks in the Panama Canal opened in 2016, right? And the projection was that increasing amounts of freight from Asia Pacific were going to go through that new locks of the canal and inbound Gulf and U.S. East Coast ports. And we have seen that bump in imports considerably over that time. But now Panama Canal is facing some pretty dire circumstances with drought. I think the number is typically 42 ships per day in a normal operation, cut to, I think, 30 per day today, and predictions of down to 18 per day come February. All bulk and oil petroleum ships have been denied access. They're going to have to go around. I saw recently there was a lottery for a slot, and a company paid $2.5 million for that slot. The container ships seem to be okay because they pre-booked those. What's your take on some of that stuff, Jim?
Well, I knew Alberto Alamon very well, know him very well, the man that was the impetus behind building the third set of locks. And they knew they could have some water issues. It was not unknown. They didn't know that they would be this bad. But I think what's happened over time, when containerization started, and I'm old enough to have seen it, speed was important. We took a lot of cargo off on the West Coast and railed it at whatever cost across the country in containers. And over time, as containerization, particularly during the pandemic, as containerization was seen as less reliable for a number of reasons, ships waiting, whatever, congestion, I think companies decided that the way to reestablish reliability is to get the cargo closer to where it's needed. So meaning 70% of the people live east of the Mississippi River, 13 states of 1 million population or more are growing, and they're mainly in the Southeast and Gulf. So there's been a tolerated acceptance of longer transit time to establish reliability, even if the absolute days are longer. And what's happened since 2019, the East Coast and Gulf has gained 5 percentage share points versus the West Coast on imports. We predicted that. It's about 50-50, and I don't think it's ever going back the other way. And everybody said, well, the strike is over on the West Coast, all the freight's going to go back to the West Coast. There's no evidence that that ever happened, and there's no evidence that that ever will happen. So you're right, the container ships are getting priority. However, I read yesterday it is starting to affect container ships.
Is it? Okay.
They're starting to route some ships via the Suez Canal, which is a longer transit time. And part of that is also that nothing stands alone in this industry. It's also tied up with the trend of shifting manufacturing from China to Southeast Asia, mm-hmm. because that, if you know geography, those ships in Southeast Asia need to go via the Suez anyway. And we've seen that China's share of U.S. imports has gone from 48 to 38% mm-hmm. in a really short period of time.
And that's a percentage of a big number.
Percentage of a big number. So China's not going away, but this China plus one thing is kind of inculcated in global sourcing today. So that feeds, so lines will go to the path of least resistance. So the Panama Canal gets congested, they will reroute the ships. Ships are mobile assets, they'll reroute the ships via the Suez Canal, which takes longer, probably takes an extra ship. But that's not a problem today because the lines have more capacity on order than they've ever had on order. 30% of the world fleet of 28 million TEUs is on order today, and those are not small ships, folks. They're 10,000 TEUs and above, and they are being delivered right now. So for a shipping line, adding another ship to a string is a way to soak up excess capacity.
Yeah.
So I think the impact of it can be minimized through those types of steps.
You talked about the China plus one strategy that a lot of companies are looking at from a sourcing standpoint. Where do you see the big winners?
Well, I mean, Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, India. I question, given the highly educated nature of the Indian society, if they truly want to be that big a manufacturing player, but apparently they do. But certainly Vietnam gained initially, Thailand, everything, Indonesia, everything moved south. But scale-wise, I think what most people don't remember is that China spent 25 years developing a very reliable supply chain. They built the Yangshan Bridge, you know, from Shanghai, 32-kilometer bridge in like 18 months. It would take us 20 years to build that.
And with massive government investment, too.
So China's not going away. The Chinese economy is very export dependent, and it has a lot of problems today.
Yeah.
So they have to keep being a player. And I think if you talk to Walmart or Target or the big importers, they can't abandon China. That's really not possible.
Right.
Hey, Jim, you were talking about pre-pandemic, through pandemic, the buildup of all those container ships sitting off the West Coast ports. And I think you, in the past, you've kind of suggested that having 40% of U.S. imports come into two ports that are located next door to each other's maybe asinine, my word, not yours. And so it presented tremendous opportunity. Again, the migration to the Southeast, people are living here in mass, distribution capacity is following. How did you all ramp up and prepare to absorb that 5% share gain that you saw? I know that certainly been tremendous investments in South Carolina ports as well as other Southeastern corridors, but how were you able to even embrace the opportunity when it presented itself?
Well, the good news, I would say, is we saw it coming. It was fairly obvious where people were moving. It was fairly obvious that ships were getting bigger. When I started with the port in 2009, the biggest ship we had was a 5,000 20-foot equivalent ship. Today, we have 16,000. And you don't hide ships when they're being built. They announce the order book, so you can see they're bigger. So we recognized immediately that we had to deepen our harbor. When the first 13,000 TEU ship came to Charleston, we had two cranes that could work the ship at full height. The rest were too short, so we had to raise cranes, buy new cranes. So we ended up investing, with the help of our state, about $2 billion in 10 years. And that same story is in Virginia. It's in Savannah. It's in Houston. The operating ports have invested heavily because they're not land constrained. And they see the benefit of ports for economic development, and they know the South. We knew the South was going to grow. We always said, I'm not an economist. I never knew what trade flows were going to do. I said, but we'll be double the U.S. port volume in the Southeast because we should grow above the market. And fortunately, we were able to do that. So a lot of blood, sweat, and tears in permitting and building infrastructure, which is never easy, improving our rail network, and really trying to expand the reach of the port to, and all along hoping we were right.
Yeah, could you expound on that, Jim? I think one of the really innovative things you did was the inland port concept, especially if you realize Charleston and the geography of Charleston is a peninsula, so it's you can only get there from one direction, so that was a constraint.
Well, intermodal rail, and what a lot of people make a mistake, they look at a rail network and they think containers can move on every inch of rail. They really move on about 5%. It's a very high-density sort of operation. And we had some land up in Greer, South Carolina, which is Greenville, and the Norfolk Southern wanted to convert the BMW container traffic to rail, intermodal container rail, and we wanted to build an inland port. We'd seen the one in Front Royal, Virginia, and we knew the Greenville area being between Atlanta and Charlotte on the 85 corridor, which is probably if you've driven it, you know, it's probably the densest freight corridor around. So in 2012, they asked us if we would work together, and we said yes. The big tension point was they said they wanted to run the inland port. We said, no, we don't like the way you run inland terminals. We want to run it more like a port. So we invested a lot of money. I mean, it's close to $100 million. Nothing's cheap in our world. And built essentially a grounded container facility, which could take chassis out of play. And the main catalyst was to serve BMW, but I would say today that less than 50% of the freight is BMW. It's very diverse. And it's actually export dominant, which is the only one like it, because BMW today, we didn't foresee it then, they export more than they import because of CKD and SKD. So just to give you some order of magnitude, I figured that in 5 years' time, that inland port, first of all, many people told me it was a stupid idea. I mean, that's the way ideas work. And I kept a few of those emails for a select
dexterity
group of friends that I'll show them one day at their retirement. But anyway, I thought it might do 100,000 lifts in 5 years. I knew it'd be successful. It's up to 160,000. The port, after I left, has meanwhile expanded it. The Norfolk Southern has expanded. I think it easily can do 250,000 lifts. And at 160,000 lifts, it's three times bigger than any other inland port. So it's port-owned inland port. So it's been amazing success. You see being Santa Fe going in this direction in the West, Kansas City, Colorado, Alliance, now Phoenix. So we've got to find an intelligent way to move more containerized freight by rail. We can't continue to have 75 or 80% going by truck because we're not going to have enough truckers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We're going to have a real shortage of truckers in this country just due to demographics and just the quality of work.
And you throw in other social issues like traffic density on the highways and carbon footprints and things like that.
So short haul, when I was in school here in the dark ages, they called it transportation, you know, you didn't do rail in under 500 miles, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that was kind of the mantra. Well, this is a 212-mile inland port. We did one in Dillon for 160 miles. And short-haul rail intermodal, I think shuttles and things of that nature, even in urban areas, extended combined statistical areas, I think there's a wave of the future there.
And you also built up your rail side capabilities in the port itself, right?
Right. We were admittedly behind in that. We had not arranged the near dock rail in the way that it needed to be arranged, but we're playing catch up there now, and I think developing a very creative solution that doesn't rely on trucks to move from the port facility to the rail, hopefully using a barge service to take trucks off the road.
Yeah.
I've said it for years, a shortage of container trucking is going to be the Achilles heel of this industry if we're not careful. We simply cannot continue to grow 5% a year with the same owner-operator truck model. It doesn't work.
Jim, let me ask you a question. I mean, we made a reference to China and how they're able to move so aggressively with a centrally controlled government, basically set a strategy as a nation, the construction follows. You know, here in the United States, obviously it's private sector, public-private enterprise as well, but there is no such thing as a national transportation strategy or policy per se. Where do you think there are deficiencies, and maybe where should government be involved and where should they not be involved, perhaps?
Well, I think I always told Ted I probably have the last national transportation policy book ever written in the U.S., and it was written in 1970.
I thought it was in
so
the 70s.
So we don't have such a policy. Right. I would say that intelligently, the best thing we can do from a public policy strategy point of view is intelligently build infrastructure. And the example I always give, if you think about the interstate highway system, which was built in the 1950s, admittedly to support war, think about this country without the interstate highway system, how you would get around here. So it was very intelligently done. The problem with infrastructure today, in my observation, is sometimes it's politicized. We don't get a lot of infrastructure grants in South Carolina because it's a red state. We're not a swing state. It goes to a lot of swing states because it's politically motivated, if I'm honest about it. And you have to pick winners and losers. And the public sector does an incredibly lousy job of picking winners and losers. How do you tell a port X, Y, or Z that you're not in the top 10? You don't need to grow. The state's not going to like that, honestly. Mm-hmm. And then although we talk ad infinitum about making permitting easier to build infrastructure, it's really not. Because there's a lot of inertia within the pipeline and the agencies that do this sort of thing to keep the status quo, because that's what they know. So I think that commit to building intelligent infrastructure to support the supply chain is important, and being able to make the right choices and do it faster. The Savannah Harbor expansion project took 25 years.
Wow.
25 years. Now, there's reasons for that. We could go have a whole podcast on that. It took us from conceiving a harbor deepening in 2010 to delivering it in 2022, 12 years. The only thing, we deepened the harbor in 2004. The only thing that changed between 2004 and 2022 was the age of the fish in the harbor that hadn't been caught by fishermen because the harbor was exactly the same, yet it had to be restudied again, et cetera. So those things are not productive in building the time. China grew in outsourcing of retail goods because they had a scalable infrastructure. They built big ports. Costco grew from nothing to the number four line in the world. And that was all a conscious strategy.
Yeah. Tom Mentzer, my predecessor here at University of Tennessee, told the story about working with some guys in the transportation ministry in China about locating highways. They did a location project and locating highways between a few major hub manufacturing cities. And he flew over to, I think it was Shanghai, maybe it was Beijing, to work with them on the year one, let's say, to talk about this design, and they figured out where they were going to do it. He flew back a year later, and they took him for a drive down the highway.
Well, I mean, the biggest city in China is not Shanghai or Beijing. It's Chongqing. It's up the Yangtze River. It's like 35 million people, and they've built infrastructure to that, right? Yeah. And we talked about new buildings of ships, and you talked about fuel. This sort of 30% of ships on order were built in spite of the fact that the shipping lines don't really know what the fuel of the future is. And it's not LNG. It's not ultra-low sulfur fuel. So I would echo what you said, Ted. I think it's hydrogen. Most people would say it. There's some ships being built with biomethanol today. But most people believe, and I would say the International Maritime Organization would tell you, that hydrogen is probably the fuel of the future for ships.
Not plastics.
Not blessed. That's a whole other topic.
But yeah, right. Yeah.
Jim, you have a very impressive track record of making some pretty big bets and having them pay off. I just wonder if you go on the record with us this afternoon and kind of cast forward, you know, what do you see the future of supply chain? And maybe bring it back a little bit to what we do here at UT and what role we can have in advancing that future, making it happen.
Again, I was in school here in the 70s. It was called transportation. It's now this big, enormous part of an organization structure called supply chain, which I think has been a great development, transportation through logistics to supply chain. So it's given great prominence to the field. I tell people, they laugh, I said the supply chain became really important when we couldn't find toilet paper on the shelves anymore. People thought that was the end of it, right?
Yeah.
So people appreciate it. So supply chain has grown in sophistication. It has to continue to grow. As I said, if you look at the four operating ports, they're building $2 billion or more of infrastructures. We have to continue to build infrastructure. I think one of the missing components in the import-export supply chain is visibility. There are good companies today. There's some are going to be here. I know Project 44 is here. I'm doing some advising for Gnosis Freight that have really honed in on container lifecycle management, because one of my friends at Gnosis explained to our governor here at McMaster, he said, you know, governor said, what do you do? He said, well, I tell people where their cargo is. He says, they don't know where their cargo is. No, they don't know where their cargo is. And we saw example after example of people ordering millions of dollars of goods, not knowing where their containers are, and paying a lot of demurrage because of that. And I always said 80% of the questions we got in customer service in a shipping line or a port were questions you'd never ask UPS or FedEx. Where's my container? Where's the ship? Is it custom cleared? That all should. So we've got to get, because if we can improve the visibility, we will improve the reliability and the efficiency of the supply chain. But I believe we're going to continue to source more foreign goods. We can't bring all the manufacturing here because we have no workforce. We're losing, I'll tell you tomorrow, we're losing 2.5 million workers a year. In this country, we have no way to make immigration legal. It's not politically palatable. So we have a problem. So Mexico and Southeast Asia, they're going to be the beneficiaries of that. And I think the other thing, and I probably poke a raw nerve here, is supply chain has grown. This procurement and operations functions have sort of become estranged a little bit. You know, procurement is purchase price variance, and operations has to deal sometimes with the mess that procurement creates. Right? And some, I think the best supply chain organizations are going to be the ones that get those in good alignment. And then the last thing you read, so you mentioned this freight forwarding thing. So about every 10 years, and I won't name companies, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, about every 10 years, someone tries to revolutionize a basic industry by digitization. And it's really about 10-year cycles. You can name the companies. And Unfortunately, the world's awash in private capital, so a lot of these private equity folks get really excited about this digitization. They overpay for these companies.
Especially when interest rates were nothing.
When money was free, right? Well, money's not free anymore. And guess what? These people that do freight forwarding are really established. Expeditors, Kuehne+Nagel, Danzas, Schenker, those are really established companies that provide great service. You're going to not knock them off the ledge because they just have some form of digitization or whatever. So we have to be realistic about what the needs are. you know, what can truly move the needle in improving the reliability and efficiency of the supply chain.
Now, you work at a, or you worked at a place that was relatively labor intensive, and you brought up a couple times about the labor issue, and you know, we're losing 2.5 million workers a year from a port standpoint, and then broader in the supply chain. What is your vision of how we're going to deal with this labor crisis? That's not short term. It's going to be around the age of the youngest person in this room. It's going to be around the rest of your life.
You know,
because that's what global demographics are doing.
So I'll say, let's talk about labor on two fronts, since you raised it earlier. I mean, the workforce issue is severe. And it wasn't caused by the pandemic. I go to a conference every year in Florida. I probably wouldn't go to that conference. It was in Cleveland, but it's in Florida in January, so I go. And we've been talking about the demographic wall that we're hitting.
Yep.
There's way more of my age people retiring and unfortunately dying than are being born, and that's 2.5 million a year. It's the number. Mm-hmm. We have to have some intelligent form of legal immigration in this country, and we probably have to stop illegal immigration to make legal immigration palatable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's not hard to see. But there's no answer without doing that. You can't automate everything. Everybody just automate. Well, that sounds nice, but it doesn't always work that way, right? So that's one thing. Labor in shipping is going to be a challenge. East Coast and Gulf labor situation, I don't think it's any secret. Our current president has said he is the most union-supportive president that we've ever had. And this has emboldened the labor unions. And in East Coast and Gulf, the carriers in the union had a chance to do an extension during the pandemic when they were all making a lot of money, and that probably could have gotten done at pretty good wages. But now they're going to try to do it in 2024. The rates have, in the meantime, slid. The results, Maersk, you saw the announcement, they're making negative results in container shipping, so it ain't going to be that easy to get a 30 or 40% increase in 2024 when that contract's up. And the head of the union yesterday basically said, we will not extend. They've always extended. Come October 1, we'll have a contract or we won't. And I don't doubt for a minute that he's sincere about that. So it will create uncertainty, particularly when you, and I don't want to get too grainy, you've got a lot of foreign flag carriers in a direct employer relationship with a union that they don't employ. That doesn't make any sense at all. It's going to create a lot of uncertainty for big shippers. It's hard to contingency plan because what do? You've got a mill in Macon, Georgia. You're going to ship over Vancouver? No. I mean, L.A.? No. You're probably not going to do that. It's not easy to do. I'm pro-worker. I think we all have to be pro-worker. Wages are a given. You have to pay today, right? I mean, if you don't pay, you won't get people. But the pro-union side of it has really, you saw it in the UAW, it's emboldened the unions. And I don't think that's going to change, short of a change in the administration.
Yeah.
And now, last thing, may I say,
please.
Just you asked me to tie it back to UT, supply chain, and I'm fortunate enough to sit on the Dean's Advisory Council, which really means a lot to me, as did this award. You know, it was really an honor having a 50-year association with the supply chain program here. And I would really say a lot of credit goes to you folks, Ted and Tom, and your colleagues, and what you have done to raise the visibility of this program and the worth of this degree from this program to the levels that it's at today. I give you a lot of credit for that. And the best years are clearly ahead. The university is going to have 70,000 applications this year. It's a record. Mm. I always tell kids the difference in a transportation and supply chain degree from the 70s and now, about 20,000 a year in tuition and about 60,000 a year in starting salary. So, I mean, that's the difference.
Well, Jim, we are where we are because of friends and alums like you. You know, we have the wisdom to listen to you and invite you in and again, to benefit from that wisdom and put it into action. So thank you for pushing us. Beyond pushing us, giving us that impetus.
Well, thank you as well.
Jim, you've been one of our closest partners for many years now. You're also on our advisory board, the Supply Chain Management, Global Supply Chain Institute Advisory Board, and have given us really insightful ways to improve our programs and our initiatives, and I thank you for that. I think this is a great way to wrap this up and welcome the folks here, and pretty soon we're going to welcome a lot more folks to the November 2023 version of Supply Chain Forum. We got we're upwards north of 75 companies that are forum partners with us right now, and we're going to welcome about 300 of their people here to Knoxville this week. And I really do believe that the partnership we have with those 75 companies and the 300 managers that come a couple of times a year to meet with us are a real reason why this program has gone where it's gone in the last 15 years or so.
Well, when I was with the port, I would say our participation in the Supply Chain Forum was one of the most meaningful things that we did. I mean, for a very reasonable cost, we could get around some of the top decision makers in U.S. global supply chain. So it's phenomenal what you've done. One of many examples.
Well, thank you again for joining us here. This is your second time with us.
Second time.
Peter Anderson out in the audience, one of our other really great partners. Peter, we got our crosshairs on you. We're going to have to get you on as a guest soon, okay? Tom, I think we'll sign off.
Yeah, let's close off. And this is the 26th anniversary edition, and we made a big deal of observing the 25th anniversary last year. I'd say we got to celebrate the 26th year just as big.
Forum.
What do you say?
The
forum.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, really excited about the next 2 days ahead of us. And again, not only our industry partners, but all those students are going to have access to such.
We expect about 700 people to roll through this room in the next 3 days between our industry partners, faculty, staff, and students.
So for those of you that aren't part of the forum, we ask you to maybe give it some consideration. How can you do that? Reach us at gsci@utk.edu. We'll get you started down the path. So with that, thank you so much. Thanks for those of you attending, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for tuning in to Tennessee on Supply Chain Management. If you enjoyed the episode, subscribe today on your favorite listening platform to get all of our episodes as soon as they drop. And don't forget to take a moment to leave us a rating. Have any questions, thoughts, or feedback? We'd love to hear from our listeners. Email us at gsci@utk.edu. Join us next time as we continue pulling back the curtain on the world of supply chain, educating and entertaining you along the way. Until then, listeners.